Welcome to the University Center for Social and Urban Research, our summer brown bag with Mike Schramm of Case Western University. We're really happy to see so many people here. This has been a big week in land banking for Pennsylvania because the Pennsylvania Housing Alliance Conference on Monday at the Pennsylvania Housing and Redevelopment Authority Conference in Harrisburg. I know a few of you were at the land bank conference. I was one of them. And today we're going to hear from Mike Schramm about Cuyahoga County's land bank. Mike's a longtime friend of ours. He is a big partner in Neo Can Do. He was one of our speakers at the 2010 PNCIS User Conference, our very first one. Neo Can Do is a partner with us in the National Neighborhood Indicators Partnership at the Urban Institute. And so we use Mike probably a string of emails between Bob and Mike, and of course, Mike has some great pictures of Cleveland that I always like, go back quite some time. So we've learned a lot from Mike over the years. We've shared a lot of information. He's got, as I told him earlier, bona fide Pennsylvania credentials from the other university, a geography degree from Penn State, and he's got a master's in geography from Syracuse. So we've got lots and lots of physical overviews and technical skills. And beyond that, Mike's been working in Cuyahoga County Land Bank, I guess formally now for two years?
4 years.
4 years. Oh, well, from the inception.
So it's 5 years old, and I've been there for 4 years.
Yeah, 2009 is the Cuyahoga County formation of the formal land bank, and Mike's been at it for a long time. Mike came in early, and we kind of relived some of our documents, and it was fun. Cleveland at the Crossroads, 2005, a study of Cleveland and vacant land, abandoned land, and the problems that were already occurring in the city of Cleveland before the foreclosure crisis. So Cleveland was set up for a lot of things in vacancy and blight for a long time because of, really because of this very early study. A couple other studies that have come out since then, our friends at Virginia Tech have part of their vacant land and blight studies, a recent one on Cuyahoga County that they put out a lot of press on, Joe Schilling there. Our colleague Dennis Keating, Dennis was one of our brown bag speakers 2 years ago. Dennis was also a speaker at GISPIA's Social Equity Conference at the end of May, did a review of the land bank, and Dennis gave me the current Cuyahoga County land bank study. That Dennis said he didn't write much of it, but his name's still in it. He wrote this one. Mike wrote that one.
Some of that one.
Some of that one. Got a lot of material for you, and welcome, Mike.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm going to send this out, the sign-in sheet. Oh. So Mike might want to be in touch with some follow-up materials. So make sure, I know we have your emails, but let's make sure we get everybody's.
And one just other quick notice, fine to ask clarifying questions in the course of the presentation and the long discussion. Do identify yourself in what organization you're with. I think that'll be part of the discussion as well, because a lot of you are active participants in current land bank efforts now, and that'll be useful for Mike when you ask a question.
So I have the pleasure of working with the city's data intermediary, the Neo Can Do project at Case Western Reserve University, similar to you guys here at University of Pittsburgh, but I also have the distinction of also being inside of the county land bank's doors so that I can basically create my data on my Neo Can Do end and then use it for effective programs and policies at the Cuyahoga Land Bank. So I'm going to kind of be all over the place because sometimes I'm going to be wearing my Neo Can Do hat and sometimes I'm going to be wearing my Cuyahoga Land Bank hat. So hopefully we don't get too thrown off. And so I'll probably give a little history of both organizations, talk about our latest data tool for the community to use, which is called the NST, and the use of the NST data by the Cuyahoga Land Bank, as well as just sort of conclude with our in-house, what we call our property profile system at the Cuyahoga Land Bank, which is basically used to manage all of our operations, because when you're dealing with thousands and thousands of properties and you have to cut the grass and you have to inspect them and you have to board them and do all of these actual land banking tasks, a robust data system is needed to do that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So Every nonprofit and government organization needs to have a mission. Ours is to strategically acquire properties, return them to productive use, reduce blight, increase property values, support community goals, and improve the quality of life for county residents. I don't think it says anything at all about improving the our football team or anything like that.
Baseball,
yes. We were doing well, but then I think we lost 3 in a row. So we are a nonprofit government at the Cuyahoga Land Bank. We're a nonprofit government-purposed corporation. We are quasi-governmental. We're incorporated by the county, but we're standalone, so we only have to report to our board, which consists of people who are from the county and the city of Cleveland and the suburban governments. But for accountability's sake, you know, we are operated by this board, but for day-to-day operations, we are making our own decisions about buying, transacting, selling, and other things like that. We do have a dedicated income stream of $7 million a year from basically penalty and interest on collected delinquent property taxes. And then we probably have about $2 million in property sales, whether they be our renovated houses or houses that we sell through what's called our deed and escrow program. We also receive grants from, you know, the NSP program. The state of Ohio had its Moving Ohio Forward demolition program, which was Attorney General robo-signing settlement money. And we are now administering some hardest hit funds from the Treasury for demolition. Like I said, we have these government powers of land banking, being able to hold property tax-free, being able to get properties through tax foreclosure, but then we have these private enterprise transactional capabilities. And really, this is kind of the three-legged stool of, you know, what makes the Cuyahoga Land Bank effective is that we have the statutory funding that says penalty and interest from delinquent taxes should be going to land banks for them to have their operations, which allows us to plan, budget, and maintain a professional staff. At least I hope I'm professional. We have expedited tax foreclosure reforms. So if a property is vacant and abandoned, it can go through an administrative tax foreclosure rather than a judicial tax foreclosure. And at the end of that tax foreclosure, it can then be directly transferred to the land bank rather than having to be exposed to sale, which just totally delays the process because nothing sells a tax sale because who wants to pay, you know, $12,000 of delinquent taxes on a burnt out shell or something like that. And then, like I said, we have these high transactional capacity because we're government but outside of government. So where do we get our properties? We have agreements with several banks: Wells Fargo, Chase, Bank of America. They provide us with low value properties. We can get properties deed in lieu of tax foreclosure. We have an agreement with HUD. Anything that has a broker's price opinion of below $25,000 automatically comes to us, as well as Fannie Mae. And then we have, like I said, this robust tax foreclosure pipeline. And in real time, we are basically figuring out, should this be renovated? Should this be saved? Should this be demolished? And it's just this rolling inventory where 75 to 100 properties come in a given month. 75 to 100 properties get knocked down in a given month, and another probably, you know, 5 to 20 get put into some sort of renovation program. And then we have to decide, you know, where things go in the end. Is there a responsible neighbor where it could go to a side yard? Can this become part of a larger aggregation for urban farming and green space? Are we working with the economic development community to bring something through tax foreclosure, and then it's, you know, adjacent to an existing business that wants to do expansion? And there's some examples of that in the report that was held up. But like I said, mostly we demolish. Yes.
Do you work with community organizations that have neighborhood plans?
We do. Basically, our CDCs, our community development corporations, are the eyes and ears on the ground for us, who help us to make some decisions on renovation versus demolition. We also work with a lot of social service agencies who, You know, we have a veterans housing program to put vets in houses who are returning. You know, we have we've worked with several both secular and faith-based social service agencies, and that's also talked about in the report that that was held up. And so we do have we call that our special projects operation, where we're basically working with these social service human services type organizations, where their mission is not housing, but they have to put people in houses, and we have houses, so there's kind of an overlapping thing. We also have worked with the developmentally disabled community. We have an organization that does workforce development, where they cut grass for us, as well as using Cork Community Service to help cut our grass, to sort of involve, you know, minor prisoners. So we opened our doors in 2009, as it was said before. The office actually opened on June 15th, even though we were incorporated on June 1st. By the time we moved into our office, it was June 15th. So if you ever need our Wi-Fi password, if you're in Cleveland, it's June 15th, 09. And we have, in 5 years, acquired over 4,000 properties, disposed of 2,900 properties. Our current inventory right now is around 11,000. We've demolished over 1,100. We've demolished 2,600, and we've facilitated over 1,000 renovations. And just one of the things to realize is Cleveland and Cuyahoga County, we do have like a dual land bank system, where our municipalities all have passive unfunded land banks that hold vacant lot for long term. They don't take structures. After we demolish, and if there's no immediate reuse, our memorandums of understanding with with the city of Cleveland and with the suburban governments is we transfer to them for long-term holding, which is why we have that high level of dispositions. We're a transactional land bank, not a long-term holding land bank, triage land bank, I guess you would call it. And we've developed in-house what we call our property profile system to manage all of these moving parts. And I'll talk about that toward the end of the presentation. Yes?
So the fees that are collected through your sort of tax levy and your penalty, they support your transactional land bank. They don't support... Yeah, when the government entities take on that comes out of their own pocket.
Like in Cleveland, a lot of their land bank maintenance is ran through their CDBG dollars and things like that. The delinquent penalty tax and interest is specifically for county land banks, not municipal land banks. And we've had municipal land banks since the late 70s. And that was how it was sort of formed, because the municipal land banks did not want to relinquish their control over their inventories and things like that. So, so I'll give you a little bit of the context of the Cuyahoga Land Bank, and just a little introduction on, hopefully you saw me in 2010 when I was last here presenting, so this is all old information for you guys, because you've been engaged with Bob and Sabina for so long now, and you're institutional members, so I just need one slide on this. We are managed, the Neo Can-Do project is managed by a research center called the Center on Urban Poverty and Community Development at Case Western Reserve University. I guess we're either the Harvard or the MIT of Ohio, not sure. And in the late 80s, we were formed to look at issues of concentrated poverty in neighborhoods. And because of that, we had to collect and disseminate neighborhood-level data at small geographies across sources. And this was late 80s, early 90s. This is when computer hard drives were like 20 megabytes, not, you know, a terabyte. And so we collected all this information across sources, wrote some reports, and people were like, wow, your data is great. We don't care about your report. We want to have your data. And so therefore, it was decided in 1992 to put the information online through a service called CanDo. It was actually a dial-up service. It predated, the internet, where you would call in with a modem, and And it was basically established this foundation for linking data across different sources. In 2005, we added mapping, we added more data, a larger geographic footprint of the 17 counties of Northeast Ohio, and we added parcel data, which is when I sort of joined the project. Our new parcel-based engine is called the NST web application. It's the Neighborhood Stabilization Team web application. And there's actually a research brief. If you guys are signed up and if Bob wants to send it out to you, I'll make sure that Bob has that. And we are a founding partner in what was referred to as the National Neighborhood Indicators Partnership at the Urban Institute, 35 cities with neo-can-do-like qualities. And Bob's our go-to person for that, and so is Sabina, but it's always better to put Bob in.
We need Bob's picture,
yes. So, really, NeoCanDo we see now as a suite of applications because it's kind of become our branding, where we have, you know, this NST web app, we have the reports that we put out, our census data, our crime data, our birth data, you know, sort of our community profiles type data. That's all part of this thing. But really, this is kind of what we're trying to accomplish. So our county does a really good job about putting its information online, but you can only look up one particular parcel at a time on 17,000 different websites, and it all should really just live in one place. There's got to be a better way, because when interns would go work for community organizations, community development corporations, they would basically spend their entire summer collecting all the information from all these various websites, putting it into an Excel spreadsheet, and then by the time they were done, the information was out of date or their summer was over and they really didn't learn anything. And so I've put all these interns working for community development agencies out of a job, because now they don't need to collect this information from the various websites. No, I'm kidding. Now they can actually do something, work with the community, do planning, rather than just collecting data, because all of this information is put into one place. It's our searchable, filterable, sortable, mappable, downloadable, property data interface that's geographically referenced. We have all these key geographies programmed in there, parcel level, and it's really a community-driven resources, because we work with our key funders as well as with all of our community stakeholders to make the system community-driven rather than, you know, from the community up rather than from the funders or from the university down, because really, working out there in the community with these organizations allows us to know what they want, what they're doing with it, ask them questions, make sure they're using the information right. It's not about data for the sake of data, but it's about data and handholding and relationships and using the data effectively to make sure that that it's being sort of used properly out there. And excuse me, here's our property data resources. We work with, we have what's called our fiscal officer, but it's like a county assessor or an auditor, where we're getting property characteristics, deed transfers, mortgage recordings, tax delinquency, property values. We do have a lot of data from Cleveland's code enforcement, building and housing department on permits, condemnations, violations, complaints, demolitions, foreclosure filings data, sheriff sales data, of course the Cuyahoga Land Bank data should be in NeoCanDo. I can't be a hypocrite, I have to put my data back in my other system and share. And then, we have some data coming from community development projects and the suburbs and things like that. And, you know, we're doing data mining to add more data. Once you combine data, you can make more data from data, because you know from the county auditor that if a parcel has zero building value and it's not tax abated, there's no building. It's a vacant lot, but yet the land use code still may say single family. The county's more interested in knowing how much tax money to collect rather than making sure the land use codes are up to date. Or, you know, when something is demolished, because we're getting that data from the county land bank or from the municipalities, that can also lead us to say, well, the county says there's a single family house, but we know because of this administrative data source coming from the city or coming from the land bank, that there was a demolition, and it really allows you to make the data better by comparing it across source. The other things we can make are, you know, the whole foreclosure process is represented at the fiscal officer, at the sheriff, at the court, you know, and it goes through all these different offices. And if you start linking that data together, you can know where the particular house is related to the foreclosure process. And so this really helps the community development organizations that we work with and the land bank to know exactly, oh, okay, that's waiting for its sheriff sale. Oh, that filing is new. Maybe we can do foreclosure prevention. You know, oh, that's tax delinquent. It's searchable. You can limit things by categories through like a filtering. If you've ever created a table in Microsoft Excel, the filtering ability is just very similar to that. Sortable, mappable. And we also bring the data into ArcGIS to make more sophisticated maps where you can see when the neighborhood stabilization team, this is actually a group that meets through Neighborhood Progress, the community development corporations, and a representative from our office, they meet at the CDC office and they basically discuss, oh, here are your assets mapped in black. Here are the destabilizing factors that are nearby. You know, can you come up with plans for interventions in order to make sure that your asset remains stable? We receive the data through email, FTP. We get DVDs in the mail still. Some things come to us through XML APIs. And we do a lot of screen scraping in which we basically steal data from government websites through automatic programs. I need to update this slide because now that Dropbox has been invented, pretty much all our data just comes in through Dropbox. All right, so we have, you know, all of these administrative data being combined into one location through the NeoCanDo project at CASE, and then we have some examples of how the Cuyahoga Land Bank uses this information. We have a renovation program called our Deed and Escrow Program, and we basically, the houses that we believe are still savable, we send an inspector out, he writes up renovation specifications. We market them on our website. Person fills out a purchasing application, and they basically say, okay, I want to buy this house because I want to renovate it and live in it. We say, all right, you got to renovate it to this standard, which is kind of code plus. It's not anything fancy. You know, warm, safe, dry, code plus, more like a Section 8 standard is the minimum spec that we write. But it brings the house back online. It becomes, you know, contributing back to the tax base. And basically, we use the NeoCanDo data to look that person up. Hey, are you a flipper? Hey, did you lose a bunch of houses to tax foreclosure? Are you in tax foreclosure? Do you own a bunch of stuff that's tax delinquent? So we look them up in the NeoCanDo data to make sure that they're already not working to destabilize our neighborhoods. And so having the NeoCanDo data in one place allows us, the land bank, to basically check the people out much faster. Then we have our tool that's called the Clumper. We actually renamed that in the report, but Bob likes the word clumper, so I left it that for this presentation. And we're basically in the world of data that can be either under control by land banks or could be put into control by land banks. We can basically divide it into different tiers looking at all these various sources. We have, you know, tier one, the properties that are in a land bank. There is site control in the public good. There's tier two, because we're tracking through the tax foreclosure process, we know what is coming to a land bank at the end of tax foreclosure. Well, tier three, these are the properties that are tax delinquent that could be steered to productive use. And so basically what we're doing is designing a way to basically aggregate the data so that here are places where there's a bunch of tier one, tier two, tier three, and there's adjacency factor that is greater than 2 acres, so that we're basically using this to make recommendations. We know that this is an area that's long, you know, been abandoned. A lot of demolition has happened in there historically, but there's still these key properties that are in private ownership that haven't been tax foreclosed yet, that have high tax balances on it. And if you actually do that tax foreclosure, all of a sudden you take these two disjointed land aggregations and you join them together. And that's the kind of analysis we're doing with the data to make, you know, sort of these tax foreclosure recommendations. Or when a developer comes to us and says, we need land because we need 5 acres to put some solar panels on, we can basically say, all right, this one has a bunch of stuff owned by Cleveland's land bank. There's a couple properties owned by our land bank. We can stare forward to tax foreclosure, and they can be ours in, you know, in a year. How's that sound? You know, things like that. It's called the Clumper Bob. And then we have what we call our eye. And basically, it's just a quick way that's linked to, it's basically the NST data linked back to the Cuyahoga Land Bank's property profile system. So that, because we're getting properties to us one at a time or in small batches. And we want to know, you know, where are they? How much, you know, is it near an area of a lot of vacant land, or is it in an area, you know, near a lot of tier one, a lot of tier two, a lot of tier three? So sort of this proximity analysis, what's next to the property? You know, are there land bank lots next to the property? And then if we keep aggregating the lots, what are all those lots that are next to each other to basically, so it's you know, the clumper allows you to find the aggregations, and the eye allows you to say, you know, here's the property, where does it fit within the aggregations? That's kind of the two distinctions between the properties. So in Cuyahoga County right now, there are approximately 20,000 tax foreclosure eligible properties that aren't already in foreclosure. The county government only has the resources and capacity to file 4,000 a year. So which ones do you pick? Do you pick ones that aren't going to make a difference, or do you pick ones that may actually make a difference for the community and things like that? So, and as well as, you know, I talked about this fast track tax foreclosure system, that's only for vacant and abandoned properties. So you need to cross-reference, you know, the tax foreclosure candidates, which ones are vacant lots, which ones are vacant structures. And we basically, there's properties that we don't want to take. We don't want to take properties in historic districts or large apartment buildings unless we have a pass-through agreement or a redevelopment agreement. And is it in somebody's target area? And we basically do this type of filtering to make recommendations to the county treasurer on which properties should be tax foreclosed, so that at the end of tax foreclosure, if nobody wants it, it can come to a land bank. Or if a land bank wants it, you know, it totally skips the sales process. And, you know, let's use data to make these choices so that they can just be the best tax foreclosure candidates for that particular year, rather than, you know, previously they were sending, like, you know, little strips of land that were cut off when they put freeways through or something like that. You know, all these things that are just kind of orphan parcels. We don't even bother sending those through tax foreclosure anymore, because what are you going to do with it? Let's send stuff through tax foreclosure that can make an actual difference in neighborhood stabilization. Yes? Yeah. So basically, well, you know, there are some development target areas. The city of Cleveland has their economic development target area. And these are basically the areas in which the city has done concentrated demolition and concentrated tax foreclosure requests for probably the last 10 or 15 years. So that you can build those 3, 6, 10 acre sort of sites within areas that are close to rail or close to freeways or something like that. So, you know, that's one example. Anything that comes up tax delinquent in the city's economic development target area zones, those automatically get referred to tax foreclosure. Our community, we have community development corporations that have, you know, specific, what are called their strategic investment impact areas or something like that, SIIs, which are the areas where they're supposed to be doing, you know, concentrated community development, stabilization type areas. And so, you know, anything in those areas get referred. You know, our Habitat for Humanity is trying to work, rather than doing a scattered site development for the next couple of years, they're just going to be really working in two nodes. So we're making recommendations in those areas. And we will do scattered in the nicer neighborhoods, we'll do scattered tax foreclosures, because if we get them, and if it needs to be torn down, it helps, because it helps that sort of tipping point neighborhood by reducing, you know, the worst house on the street. And if it's not the worst house on the street, that becomes something we could plug into our deed and escrow program. I don't think I ever finished deed and escrow. The deed stays in escrow until you do the renovations, and we check up on you every 30 days. But anyway, it's a way to get deed and escrow properties in the nicer areas where, you know, you're actually, you know, you can make a difference. And a report we did shows that if you do demolition in higher value neighborhoods, you actually recoup your demolition dollars by adding property value. Yes.
Some of the areas, wherever the final report is, keep that in mind. Some of the strategic areas are in there.
Is that electronically available?
It is. If you go to the Cuyahoga Land Bank's website, and I'll go at the end of the presentation, I'll show you where you can read more about the deed and escrow program and get these reports, as well as some of the NeoCanDo reports. I'll put that on there. So, because at the land bank we're dealing with, you know, 100 new properties in a given month, doing all these demolitions, we've basically put together what we call our property profile system. It's a cloud-based web application that basically, you know, anything we do on a given property gets put into this database. It's, you walk around the office and everybody has it up on their screen. It's the one-stop shop for internal land banking, and it's really been operations driven up rather than technology driven down. So we build these new modules as the land bank undertakes new activities, new programs, things like that. And it basically, you know, allows us to track all our dates, all of our statuses. There's modules for field work, inspections, contractors, automatic document creation. So you type it in once, and then you can hit a button and produce all these nice PDFs. We have like 500,000 pictures uploaded in there, because every time somebody goes and does something to the property, they have to take a picture to let us know that they were there, that they actually cut the grass. And, you know, we check on them to make sure that, you know, we don't want to be Cleveland's biggest slumlord. When we get a property that's been neglected for, you know, 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, 5 years, you know, and we just do that initial cleanup, the residents are ecstatic because we do such a good job keeping our properties clean. It's tied to NeoCanDo. It's tied to our public website. So as the internal status has changed, the public status has changed. It's tied to our finance system. And it allows us at any particular point to know, when I made that slide that says, how many have we transacted? How many have we demolished? Blah, 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 blah. You know, that I clicked a button and that report came up. So we enter data once, and then it gets basically plugged in where it's needed. There's built-in data validation. We can't renovate a house that is in a demolition trajectory, or demolish a house that's in a renovation trajectory. You know, we want to make sure that nothing slips through the cracks. So every morning at 7:45, all the staff members get emails and says, hey, why is this grass cutting late? Hey, why hasn't this inspector inspected this house? You know, that are basically automatically generated based on all the statuses in the system. You know, why are we still holding this property for Slavic Village Development? You know, they were supposed to take it 60 days ago. Why is it still in our inventory? You know, all these various exception reports, I call them NAG reports, go out 7:45 every morning. You know, it has the ability to, you can look up properties or you can run a report. It's going out to get the latest NeoCanDo data. It's just a bunch of buttons and forms and links, the ability to keep photos, the ability to run reports. The photos appear in the reports if you want to. Link to our internal website. So as soon as something, you know, somebody submits a purchase order, it switches. We change it in the system internally, and it says pending transfer on our website. Or as soon as it gets sold or disposed to a municipality and somebody clicks the disposed button, it goes disposed. All of our contractors are assigned through the system. So our people going out to cut the grass, they know, hey, I got to go cut the grass on, you know, by June 15th. And then they upload their photos and they upload the fact that they went and cut the grass on June 15th into the system. And then a new work order gets issued, or our various inspectors are assigned through there. here's some PDFs that are created from the various forms. Just because, you know, there's a lot of paperwork that needs paper files and signatures, and, you know, our contractors need proceed orders to go pull permits and our, you know, purchase agreements and, you know, all this paperwork that needs to be produced that is basically being produced at the touch of a button. And like I said, here's our slide on our property maintenance module where, you know, this company needs to go do these properties this week, these properties next week, and things like that. Here's our production report. So when I made this slide the first time I did this presentation, we were only at 2609. What are we at now? Like 4,000 something? And then you can also export the data to create more advanced metrics. So when I put this together, you know, it says, okay, number of days between demo proceed date and demo complete date. It looks like most, you know, 30% are coming down within 15 days. Another 20% are coming down from 16 to 30 days. You know, you could do all these things to make sure that things are moving through your system efficiently. We're actually in the process of trying to license this software to other land banks. We've had very strong interest from 6 at this point. And the more land banks that participate, the cheaper it will be for everyone. I was actually talking to Cook County before this presentation. We submitted an RFP a couple of weeks ago, and it was our final interview before they make their decision. And we're really redesigning it right now to be not an off-the-shelf product, but a series of building blocks that can be combined to make every land bank's database unique. What we're basically finding out as we talk to all these other land banks, they all have different programs. It's not a one-size-fits-all type software solution. You know, in Michigan, they do quiet titles, and I had never heard of a quiet title. You know, they get all of the properties if they're occupied or unoccupied. They need to do evictions. We rarely do evictions. Sometimes a squatter will show up in one of our houses, and you know, it's a system that realizes that land banking operations, though perceived as straightforward, are actually really, really, really complex because, you know, you have the idea of, well, we'll just take properties no matter what. And then you realize, oh, we took that 6,000 square foot house. All of a sudden, we have a $100,000 asbestos abatement bill. Or, oh, we're in a historic district. We can't demolish this house. And in order to renovate it, it's going to cost $6 million. You know, so these are, you know, sort of the things that a system needs to sort of take into account. Or the constant decision when you have, you know, somebody, we have a house slated for demolition, somebody's like, no, I can save that, and then we go out, create specs, the spec comes back at $70,000, no, I don't want it, you know. So anyway, it seems like a big hassle to build data systems for other land banks, but we think that that by helping other land banks be more efficient, the better off the land banking movement will be, because the successes of other land banks makes our land bank look better, and if other land banks screw up, it looks bad for all land banks. And that's really sort of why we got into this world of wanting to help out other land banks and getting into the world of developing and licensing property management, property tracking software for them. I went a little late.
No, you're fine. Thanks, Mike.
Great. Oh, so before, just a couple of resources out there. So the Cuyahoga.
You want to hold up the report there and keep that moving along so everyone can take a look at it?
So the URL for the Cuyahoga Land Bank is cuyahogalandbank.org. And under What's Happening, there is a link to publications and reports. So this is where you can download an electronic copy of what's being passed around, as well as the one we did back in 2011. And then you can also look at, we do a newsletter once or twice a month, and you can see all the exciting things that we do. I talked heavily about our unique deed and escrow program, which is under Engage Us, Buying a House to Renovate. And this basically talks about, you know, how we've been so successful, or how you participate in this program, which gets private dollars in to do an unsubsidized renovation, which is kind of unheard of in the world of NSP, you know, neighborhood stabilization program. There was a gap in Cleveland to do rehabs to the NSP standard. There was like a $90,000 gap that was being subsidized through public dollars, and our deed and escrow rehabs do not have any public subsidy whatsoever built into them. And you know, the work gets done, the houses are decent, they're good, they get put back onto the tax duplicate, and you know, it's just a good thing. The other thing to point out is if you go to povertycenter.case.edu, there's a link to foreclosure, and that's where you can read all of the foreclosure reports we have done. But there is this briefly stated that talks about our neighborhood stabilization team web application and its development. So the foreclosure link on povertycenter.case.edu.
Good. My name is Phil Spencer. I'm a graduate student at Carnegie Mellon in public policy. Thanks for calling today. So my question is, what you just said about the rehabilitation of rehabbing. So are most people who buy these kind of investors whose end goal is Section 8 or renting or owner-occupied or what?
We're running about a 40% owner-occupancy rate, which is actually pretty good. And if you go to our website, we actually have a program called the Owner-Occupant Buyer Advantage Program, which we save the houses that need the least amount of rehab. We put them into an auction-style format for 30 days, and we allow owner-occupants to bid, and then it gets just fed through our deed and escrow program, which is our supervised renovation program. But we save the nicer stuff for owner-occupants, because they might not be able to operate as fast as the private people. We also will take a lower for the stuff that doesn't go through the owner-occupant buyer advantage program. Our priority is if an owner-occupant wants it first, we will actually allow them to pay less money than an investor. So we will give it to the owner-occupant first, then the CDC second, and then the investor is third in line. And that's our policy. This, if you go to the Poverty Center's foreclosure page, there's a report called The Role of Investors in 1-3 Family REO Market. And there's actually some analysis done in this report on sort of taking different rehab specifications and then running them through to see, you know, at what level do you break even, at what level do you make money. It's somewhere in this report. It's like a million pages long, and I'm on it, and I never actually read the report. Yes.
My name is Joe Mingenfeld. I've worked in Cleveland, worked on Neighborhood Progress, and have been in Pittsburgh for the past couple of years. I was just wondering, so you're talking about how the numbers work. How do you make the numbers work in that escrow account? Is it always, you always make a profit or at least break even on that?
So basically, for the deed and escrow program, in order, I mean, we're on some houses we make money, some houses we break even. If we're giving it to a CDC, the CDC actually has to, it's a dollar sale, but they still have to pay us our costs. So if we have any maintenance costs or transactional costs associated, that actually is paid for by the CDC. Most of our houses being sold, you know, through the deed and escrow program, are selling from $4,000 to maybe $15,000. But if you remember, our acquisition costs are minimal, so you do that a couple hundred times a year, and you make $1 million or $2, and it's more of program income. It's not true profit because you have your field servicing costs worked in there, and
you're giving away the profit. Basically, you're not involved in the renovation costs at all.
Not through deed and escrow. The only, we write the spec, they have to renovate it to that spec. But we're out there every 30 days making sure that they're renovating it, because we don't want it to just sit there and keep destabilizing the neighborhood. And so, you know, our property profile system sends an email every 30 days to the inspector that's assigned and basically says, hey, go out, check out 123 Main Street and make sure that they're on task and let us know how far they are into it. And, you know, everybody's contracted to get their deed and escrow renovations done in 120 days. Really, it's more of taking 180 days. And like I said, we don't transfer the property until the renovations are done. They show us the permits, they show us the certificate of occupancy, and then at that point we get the money from the escrow company, they get the deed from the escrow company, and you know, it's however they want to finance it, they finance it. You know, a lot of people have you know, are you know, people, construction people who have a garage of shingles, and so they'll use those shingles because they're buying a house for their daughter or something, like, you know, it's a lot of sweat equity that's going into these deed and escrow rehabs.
Have you had any that have fallen through?
Yes.
About how many?
We're in the process of evaluating that right now. It's probably been 6 to 10 at this point. I mean, but over you know, so we facilitated, you know, around 1,000 renovations. Probably 600 of those have been deed and escrows. The other ones have been either in-house rehabs where we are the general contractor, or, you know, the CDCs or some sort of NSP rehab. But out of the approximately 600 deed and escrows, you know, to have only 10 fall out is, I think, pretty good. Thank you for providing that context.
1%.
And we have, you know, and one of the things that we've done in the property profile system is we now have ticklers. When something goes 120 days late, they get an automatic letter gets generated, and it's kind of the, hey, what's going on, please see us type thing. And then at 180 days, hey, you know, if you don't finish this renovation, we may terminate your contract. And then 210 days go by, and hey, you know, if you don't finish this within a week, we will terminate your contract. So they get harsher and harsher as time progresses.
Can you talk a little bit about what it took to build that property and project management system?
So basically, the first version was built by me over the course of 4 years, because as we develop new programs, and our programs department or our demolitions department have great ideas and bring me in on their meeting, and then I say, well, sure, we could do that, or haven't you thought about doing it this way? So it's really kind of, you know, flying the plane as you go. Now, this 2.0 version, which is basically rebuilding the same system, just with much more flexible technology, if we get the Cook County project, and if we execute with Hamilton next week, we're going to have a prototype done by the end of summer. I actually have additional staff now to help me do that. I have two half-time programmers, basically, at my disposal, plus myself.
I have two questions, Mike, and built on Laura's question. One is, how many, and I know the answer is some number plus, but how many people work for the land bank now?
It's the staff size.
It's around 30.
Yeah. Okay.
It's around, and then there's probably another 15 contract employees that are in our office, like, every day, because they're out, you know, not demolition contractors, more like professional staff, like inspectors and surveyors, who people think work there. but you know, we have what we call the sweatshop, a room of computers that they can use where they can't get on our network, but they can fill out the things that they need to fill out. So it's you know, it's 30 full-timers plus, like I said, 10 to 15 regular contractors who are out there doing things for us on a daily basis.
How many different business processes are there in the land bank that involve data?
All of them.
Is there a number?
I'm sure there is, but I...
I'm just kind of curious, like, is it in the 20s, 30s?
I would say it's probably in the 30s or 40s. You know, to demolish something in and of itself is probably 10 processes right there, where you are... First of all, you're figuring out what you need to demolish. Then you need to check to make sure to check out the asbestos. If there's asbestos needs to be abated, then you have to abate the asbestos, and you have to bid the demolition, but you also have to combine removing the asbestos with when the house is going to come down, because, say, the windows, the window glazing has asbestos in it that needs to be removed, and all of a sudden you take the windows out and you have a wide open house. If it's going to be days or weeks between when that asbestos gets removed and the demolition contractor comes there, you know, then you're going to have an open, vacant, vandalized house, and that's not good for your reputation to have a wide open house. Then you got to worry about cleanouts, because household effects and construction debris go to different landfills. And we found it's cheaper to bid out cleanouts separately than do it as part of our demolition contract. Then after the demolition is done, you need to go there to make sure they didn't damage the sidewalk, that they, well, you actually have to be there to make sure they remove the foundation, because sometimes they won't, or you got to keep your eye on certain contractors, and then you need to make sure it's properly compressed and seated, graded. You need to make sure curbs are replaced, aprons are removed. So you got that whole inspection process, and then we actually hold a 10% retainage. So the house gets knocked down, we'll pay you 90%, but we're going to wait that 10% to make sure that the site is finished properly and that grass is growing. So we got to go out there until you make sure the grass is growing, there's no big rocks in the middle of the yard. And meanwhile, you know, somebody who's doing a private demolition dumps a bunch of shingles on your lawn, so you have to go clean those up. So it's probably at least 50 processes.
Quick time.
Donald Simpson, a recent PhD in the street market. I was, you mentioned the national movement of land banking. I was wondering if you had any opinion about how that's going. Do you have models when you were building your software? I'm interested in Rust Belt software.
Well, I mean, there's land banking models, and then there's software sort of on top of that, you know. And if you think about it, in Ohio, that's the only land banking legislation that provides statutory funding, this penalty and interest on delinquent taxes. Nobody else has that. Genesee was getting that as through a friendly agreement with the treasurer who founded it. But when Kildee was no longer the treasurer, they stopped receiving that penalty and interest from Genesee County. And, you know, that led to them having huge property maintenance issues and things like that. You know, right now, through settlement money and through government assistance, there have been, you know, large grants that are out there. Illinois has something similar to our Moving Ohio Forward. It's state attorney general money for demolition. You know, Michigan has the hardest hit money. But the biggest thing that's missing from other land banks in other states are this dedicated funding. You know, land banks, if they have all these great transactional and land banking capabilities, it's like a Corvette, but if you don't have gas for that Corvette, aka money, then what are you going to do?
I'm curious, particularly about Detroit, there's just a lot of stuff properties on the market.
Yeah.
Legacy. And I'm just wondering, I assume you're a forefront of this movement, and you guys have a. Do you look at other places, other areas of the country, and think like out there in the Stone Age?
We do. Yeah, and like I said, the Stone Age is definitely related to, you know, all the other states not having the funding mechanism built in, just saying, oh yeah, we're going to live on property sales, and you know, you can do stuff on property sales. It can, you know, Genesee still maintains a staff of probably 15 or 20, but they'll only do demolitions when these one time, you know, they did get $20 million. Through hardest hit for demolition. When that's gone, they're going to be back to their minimum $2 million budget. You know, when, you know, Cook County goes through its version of Illinois' attorney general money, or I think they're going to also get some hardest hit money in Illinois for demolition. You know, when you're done with that, are you going to have to fire, you know, lay off everybody off? You know, is there going to be this constant ramp up, ramp down, ramp up, ramp down, you know, where we can kind of have this base core corporate funding that allows us to maintain some level of consistency in our staffing levels and some sort of level of programmatic activities, even if these special pots of money didn't come along.
I'd like to, we will get to Rich and then Jim, but I've got one. This, if normally during the year we would have a set of nonprofit management students from some of the, our brown bags. And in essence, you and the land bank have set up a social enterprise.
I guess so.
You set up a dedicated funding stream. It's in your interest for taxes and to get collected on tax lien properties and delinquent properties. You've also benefited initially from two nice-sized chunks of money, one federal and one state, to get you up to scale to then be able to produce this stream of money and then ultimately to get properties back in circulation, which also produces stream of money. Now, you know, you guys are really being much more entrepreneurial with your software program, too.
And actually, the other
you're,
things...
beyond being a model and you're a
we
model
should be opening up our own asbestos company that's a wholly owned subsidiary to do asbestos surveys and asbestos remediation so that we can basically contract with ourselves. We have our own title company that we've established. We're a 49% partner with another title agency as a you know, so that we can basically recoup some of our expenses through being partners in other organizations and being out in being in this space.
My colleague Kevin Kearns, who runs the nonprofit clinic in Johnson Institute, is going to be very interested in a lot of the things you're doing. So you might get some calls from the not land banking side of our university, but the nonprofit management folks as well. Jim?
I'm interested. We were at land banking. My name is Jim Price. I'm with the Congress of Neighborhood Communities, a public policy advocacy group that works with the 36 municipalities that surrounds Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh itself. So similar kind of structure, except a little bit smaller than the county itself. And we were at a land banking conference earlier this week, and one of the things that Kim, and I don't remember
Graziani. Right, Graziani, yeah.
Who works with the Center for American Progress.
Community Progress, excuse me.
Had said that Cuyahoga Land Bank was the only land bank that doesn't struggle for money. And could you explain the funding structure? Because I think, I mean, the state level funding structure that allows you to get that $6 or $7 million in tax fees. Because I think that's something that Pennsylvania should probably try to lobby for, especially if it allows you and enables you to do all these other things and enables the
right.
I mean, it's more complicated than I described, but basically, you know, if our property taxes are due twice a year. If you don't pay in January, it's late. If you don't pay in July, it's delinquent. And the moment you don't pay, $100 late fee gets put on there, and then probably a 10% penalty for every single month gets put on there. But then you come along and pay, the amount goes out to the municipalities, the school districts, the libraries, you know, the taxing districts. They're made whole on that payment. And we get a portion of that penalty and interest, which if you combine that over the people who actually pay, you know, many, many, many transactions, that turns into probably $7 to $8 million a year. Our county legislation caps that to $7 million a year. But like I said, the state legislation creates this funding mechanism. And because this funding mechanism is also like reliable, We've also bonded out off of that. So to get us between our NSP money and our Moving Ohio Forward money, we floated a probably $15-16 million bond to do some demolition earlier. I think that's going to be paid off in a couple of years. So because it's a reliable funding stream, you can also then make money off of that, you know, bond off of that and pay that back because, you know, things are going to stabilize, but they'll stabilize faster if you knock out as much blight as possible, as fast as possible. And so that's kind of, you know, where we are. But I can't really talk about the financial mechanics or the statutory mechanics that make that possible because I'm a data guy, not a finance guy. But I hope that helps.
Rich?
Yes. In sustainable transportation, and two parts. One is one controversy, and then one controversy, and then what's your biggest success? Would you say?
So there has been no major controversies. Successes. It's as Gus Frangos, our president, will say, it's 100 little stories. You know, it's being able to find a vacant 5-acre site so that the developmental disabilities group can put in their own urban garden greenhouse thing, the Koinonia thing. If you read about it, you know, that's big for them. It's not that big for the county. It's the couple of car dealerships we used federal money to tear down to pave the way for some economic development. You know, we're working on a big business expansion in the suburbs where we got some tax delinquent property that's allowing you know, a big local business to stay. It's like I said, 100 little stories, and read about them in our thing and sign up for our newsletter so you can read them.
Sorry. Who sets this governance question? Who sets policies around demolition and also property disposition? That's been a contentious issue here. How does that work there?
So our demolition decisions are based on real inspections. We inspect the properties, we look at the major systems mechanicals, and we say, can this be rehabbed for a reasonable amount of money? The other thing is that there are perfectly good properties that are in terrible areas, and we will try to market them in our deed and escrow program. And because we can track through our property profile system, every time we show the houses to a potential user or a potential buyer, we see that we've had this house 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, a year. There has been absolutely no interest. It's in a challenged area, and we may demolish a perfectly good house because of the fact that there's no interest, and we do not want that long-term exposure for the liabilities of sitting on that particular house. As far as, you know, making our sales decisions of who to sell renovated houses to, you know, that's our call of who to sell it to. Do we sell it to the CDC? Do we sell it to the owner-occupant? Do we sell it to the investor? We've internally decided that owner-occupants are the desired people to sell it to, so we've made that decision in-house. When it comes to vacant lots, we do need, for our side yard program, because our memorandum of understanding with the City of Cleveland is they get the lots after demolition, they have to work for side yards. We do have to get councilmatic approval for side yards only. But if we're going to sell something for not side yards, then we can just deal directly with the person who we're disposing to.
I'm Thea Young. I'm a resident. Who specifically, like if you're looking at your organizational chart, who has the responsibility to make the decisions about which properties get acquired and which properties are disposed to whom?
So we have a when it comes to our agreements with HUD and Fannie Mae, we have to take what they give us on the and from the bank. So on the acquisitions end, if it's coming from HUD or Fannie Mae, if it's coming through tax foreclosure and it meets our criteria, which are pretty boilerplate, we take it. We take. We have a team review. Oh, our acquisitions department. We have in our organizational chart, there's an acquisitions department. Yes. Does that answer your question?
Well, in the disposition, is that staff, is that a board or an advisory council?
It's our staff. Our staff is making the decisions on who to dispose to.
After that nice PPS version 2. There's a lot of data that goes into that to see us.
Yeah.
And?
So my follow-up question to the, and you may have answered it, so it's the staff's judgment call to make the determination to tear down the house that's been sitting on the market.
Yep.
Do you ever through your agreements, do you ever transfer those properties to other entities, local community groups or CDCs who say, you know, we don't want all of these vacant lots, we want the houses to stay,
if
we'll take on the liability?
We have done that, yes, where we have transferred to a CDC or a local government who wants to take on the liability, and if it's a borderline thing, yes, we have done that.
Are they on the same timeline with your call, your one more aggressive call after another about meeting their date?
No, because that's just in the deed and escrow program. If we give it to a CDC, you know, that's the CDC's responsibility. They're the ones charged with the stabilization activities in their neighborhood.
And if they wanna
take that property, now if they take that property and sit on it and it becomes wide open and they're contributing to blight, we may rethink transacting with that CDC again, because we want to transact with CDCs who have a reputation for making sure their neighborhood is stable.
Okay, last question?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. No, go ahead. Yeah, then he'll be the last question. Yeah.
You mentioned that you obviously won't take the historic district because you can't demolish and not large criminals. Are there other major cultures that you have or you want to take property?
And we will take in those circumstances if we have an end user. We sign a pass through with that end user that says if we get the property and we'll set on it for 30, 60, 90 days. After 90 days, you have 90 days to line up your renovation plan and your financing. We're transferring it to you because it has a signed put agreement and a signed deed that allows us to, and a power of attorney that allows us to go record that deed in your name. So we will take, but we just need protections that we're not going to have that ongoing situation. You had a second part, I think.
Just, you prefer not to take the large apartment buildings. I wondered if there were other major ways that you filter out
like commercial, industrial, unless we have a put agreement. Yeah. You know, we're sort of doing neighborhood stabilization through housing unless we need to act in the world of commercial. You know, we do transact commercial structures all the time. But it's more of for redevelopment or small ones where, someone can make a case for us to tear down to expend that extra money because it's a key intersection. They bring us a data-driven argument of why we should acquire and tear down, and you know, working with our community partners. So, it's not a hard no, but it's a no, but you got to make a case and bring some skin to the game.
Carlos Savoy, I'm in the public policy department. My question has to do with any partnerships around MLS systems for realtors, whether they're residential or commercial, for driving some of the inventory.
You know, we just basically work with realtors to do our broker price opinions, and we work with realtors to sell what we rehab internally. We probably rehab 5 to 10 a year internally. But as far as the larger real estate community, I think other people may have, you know, we've done presentations. I haven't personally done any presentations in that world. And I don't know how in-depth our outreach has been in that world. I'm aware of our operations from the data perspective, but Gus, our president, Dennis, our programs director, are always meeting with people, and I have no idea until I actually have to do something to make changes to the property profile system to reflect whatever new reality we face that particular week. The other thing to realize about land banking is one day in the life of the Cuyahoga Land Bank is like most people's weeks. One week is like most people's month. One month is like a year. It's like a time warp. I have been gone since, I've missed 6 hours today of work or something like that, 5 hours. I don't know. I usually get in between 7 and 7:30. When I get back on Monday, it'll be like I've been on vacation for an entire week. What I've missed. All the new ideas, all the exciting things that are happening.
Well, Mike, once again, I want to go ahead and follow.
The reason I brought it up is just that the MLS systems use the property base from the county assessor's office.
Right. For NeoCanDo purposes, I've always wanted to work with the MLS people because that's also great data, and I just haven't figured out the best way to approach them because that's kind of a private database, but yet it's going into some sort of public entity. I think that's a good question for the NNIP world. Has any NNIP partner on the record worked with MLS data. I know I've worked with it off the record, but
Phyllis Betts in Memphis did.
She did, okay.
Yeah. Mike, thanks so much. This was fantastic.